Welcome to the Muscle Expert Podcast with Ben Pakulski, one of the world's top professional bodybuilders, an expert on human performance and mindset mastery. Ben dives deep to deliver the strategies of the top experts to upgrade your body, mind, muscle, strength, performance, biochemistry, and how to become the upgraded modern man. Join us on BenPakulski.com to learn the cutting-edge techniques to take control of your body, your brain, and create your greatest life.
What's up, ladies and gents? Ben Pakulski, the host of the Muscle Expert Podcast. Welcome back. Another amazing guest, and we do it every time, and I keep surprising myself with how awesome the people are that we get on here. And this gentleman is the number one formulator of supplements in the world, but he's also so much more than that. He's a passionate guy. He's just an incredible human being, and we have such a linear view that we thought we'd get on and have a conversation about health optimization for men, longevity, even getting into things like optimizing your brain, microdosing LSD, a lot of really cool stuff. So we're going to get at it. Mr. Sean Wells, man, welcome.
Thank you for having me on, Ben.
Dude, so, yeah, I mean, Sean and I got on the call and we started talking for 15 minutes about stuff that we're like, God, we should be recording this. Then isn't that always the case, right? So Just to give the listeners a good bit of a background, just on the conversation we were having before, so I was telling Sean about the framework we're trying to develop now for health optimization for men over 35. And teaching you guys how to, you know, make the most of your brain, your body, your balls, and extend your life. And you had some amazing insights into your past. And, you know, this is going to go, down amazing roads. And I'm really excited to hear your perception and your view as to what health optimization looks like for you and what you're doing to influence it.
Yeah, some of my my passion really started when I worked for over a decade as a chief clinical dietitian, and I worked not only in acute care, but long-term care. And, long-term care freaks people out because it's nursing homes, essentially.
Yeah.
But for me, that's where I found my heart. Like, I really feel like a lot of those people get discarded, not treated like humans.
Yeah, at one point, those were you. Like, and that's the thing people don't realize. Like, at some point, they were young too, you know?
Right, exactly. And it's fascinating to talk to them, even the ones that are demented and hear their story and see their pictures and treat them like people. But it definitely made me passionate to look into, you know, muscle loss, to look into Alzheimer's dementia and, you know, cognitive deficiencies. And then, you know, when you start thinking about, okay, muscle loss, cognitive deficiencies, that translates to, in a healthy human, a lot of these same supplements, a lot of the same nutrition, a lot of the same things, the medications, are things that would optimize what you're saying, men over 35.
Yep.
So, you know, it's really one and the same. And when you look at these things, it's optimal for you if you have a healthy brain and you have a fairly healthy life. And it's something that would, you know, be curative potentially, or at least therapeutic for these people.
And so just to give the listeners a framework as to why I choose men over 35, there's an inevitable point. If you're not there yet, you don't know what I mean. But if you are there, you know exactly what I mean. There's an inevitable point in your life where you go, fuck, I can't live like this anymore. I can't eat whatever I want. I can't train however I want. My sex life isn't quite where I want it to be. My relationships aren't where I want it to be. I'm really doing awesome in a lot of things in my life. But there's kind of these things that I'd like to be a little bit better. And if I keep going this way, I know I'm going to have some health problems really, really soon. And that's a conversation that a lot of guys have. And like, man, I really love my life. I want to live a long time. Like, I want to live to be 120. Not only do I want to live to be 120, I want to run a marathon when I'm 100. And how am I going to do that? You know, and that's the conversation that it needs to look like. And how can I just extend my life 5 years? That, to me, that's futile, right? Like, I don't want to extend my life. I want to extend the quality of life. Right. Living a long life in a nursing home, ultimately with dementia, sounds like a terrible existence. And we don't want to be there. So how do we extend? Now, how can I feel like I'm 35 until I'm 90? That's what we're after, right? So when you're working in the nursing home with these people, Sean, what were some of the things you saw or looking like, maybe dissecting it a little bit? Like, you saw dementia, you saw, muscle loss. What are some of the things that we should be looking at now that can prevent that?
Yeah, so some of those things, like, you know, it's frustrating when you look back, and, you know, I was trying to put people on creatine, for example. I wrote a chapter on that in the ISSN textbook.
Yeah.
And there's over 500 studies on creatine. And I'd get in an argument with the physician there, and the physician would say, you know, it's supplement, so it doesn't work. and then he has them on some drugs that, you know, that really are almost ineffective, quite often ineffective, actually. Yeah. Like some of the Alzheimer's drugs in particular, very weak. And, you know, we'd have that conversation, and the studies that go around these drugs are very poor. And I don't know if you know the process, like with the FDA, but sometimes, like, you can have a drug fail essentially in 10 studies, and then it's nominally different, like 2% better, and it'll pass through.
Well, I didn't know.
And so, yeah, it's frustrating. So, you know, they say, okay, this drug has studies. It's, you know, it's pharmaceutical, so it's legit. It's, you know, it's FDA, but, you know, it doesn't make it better than, by any means, by any stretch, like some of these supplements. And, you know, I would have them on nootropics. I would have them on things that optimize muscle protein synthesis. You know, what's cool about creatine is it's actually both. It helps with brain function. Yeah. It also helps maintain lean body mass.
Yep.
You know, especially like in these cases with sarcopenia, where they're losing lean body mass. And here's how important it is, and it actually helps with bone mass too. Here's how important it is. If these people in these situations aren't, you know, doing enough exercise, they're not getting enough protein, they're not getting turned enough, they're not moving enough, what happens is they get pressure ulcers. And that's actually like the muscle wearing down, and then it gets down to the bone, and then it's an open sore, and, you know, they're not getting turned enough, and, you know, no blood gets in there. So nutrients like oxygen can't get in there.
Sure, yeah.
And they die. They literally die from not being turned enough.
Like sepsis, like infections and stuff.
Yeah. Urine, feces, other things can get in there, assuming like there's a lot of incontinence too.
Right.
Yeah. So it's very sad. Or, you know, I've also seen just people, they have, low bone mineral density. They fall. You know, they break a hip, then they get pneumonia when they're in the nursing home or a urinary tract infection, and then they're gone.
Right.
Because so they broke a hip.
Sure, yeah.
You know what I mean? And they were like 65 in decent health, and then they're gone.
So if we follow that pathway back 30 years or 40 years, what's the catalyst, man? What's the one that sets it off in the wrong direction, you know, from your perspective? Is it like, can we narrow it down to three or four things? Is it going to be like, you know, from my perspective, my thought would be inflammation, sleep, being your two primary. I'm sure there's many more, but if you can mitigate inflammation or minimize inflammation and optimize sleep, you tell me, man. I'm sure there's much deeper than that, but if we want to live to be 95 and, you know, still have abs and still be able to have sex with my wife, what does that look like now?
Yeah, one of the biggest things as we age is insulin resistance. And that can actually happen. Part of that can happen because of poor sleep. So what you're talking about. They've shown studies that people that get less than 6 hours, you know, that have higher stress, they have greater insulin resistance. And that's aside from the diet and exercise. So, But certainly if we look at insulin resistance, it kind of goes hand in hand with leucine sensitivity, I'll say. Or whatever the leucine threshold is.
Okay.
So think of like, and I also think not only with insulin resistance, but also maybe androgens have a role in this. But so when you're young, the leucine threshold to maybe turn on muscle protein synthesis.
So people talking about mTOR pathway?
Yes. Okay. And people think, oh, you know, like the young guy needs tons and tons of protein, tons and tons of leucine. Actually, it's because he's highly insulin sensitive, because he's high in androgens. I'm using a man, for example, a young man. He will have a much lower leucine threshold. So maybe it takes 1.5 grams, let's say, to turn muscle protein synthesis on optimally.
Yep.
But as you age, as your insulin sensitivity goes down, you can't reach that peak threshold in plasma.
Why?
As
do we know what is it like? Has anybody dissected the mechanism as to why it degrades? No.
No, but I mean, this is mine theoretically, but I think it makes a lot of sense. So when we have our androgens go down, our insulin sensitivity go down, then this leucine threshold keeps getting higher and higher. And especially if you get immunocompromised, like a lot of people are in, like, say, a nursing home. And so, you know, it goes to 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, whatever it is. If they have burns, if they do have wounds, then maybe it's 7, 8, 9 grams of leucine. And this is the problem. This is what happens, and it's called sarcopenic obesity.
Yeah.
You're trading body composition as you age. So you can potentially be the same weight over 30 years, like going from, you know, 40 to 70, you could be the same weight. But the problem is you're trading off muscle for body fat, and you're also losing bone mineral density. And so, you know, that's a big thing, is that they're not getting enough leucine to turn on muscle protein synthesis. There may be other approaches, like giving them testosterone replacement and improving their insulin sensitivity with exercise and something like metformin or berberine or something like that.
That's my question, man. Is insulin resistance inevitable? Like, no matter what, is it, the process of cellular aging, is that going to influence it? Or is there something that, like, hey, man, I know my insulin sensitivity is optimized when I'm 18, and if I don't eat like an ass, maybe I can keep that? Or, like, or is it, I'm sure some decline is inevitable, but at what level can we influence that and maybe maintain it? And the question maybe ultimately is, what has the greatest negative influence on insulin resistance or insulin sensitivity?
I think what you're saying, I mean, obviously there is some potential level of decline, but I don't think it's just inevitable, like we should, you know, give up. I certainly think, you know, exercise, when we exercise, you activate the GLUT4 receptors, right? So you're pulling in more glucose into the cell.
So that's non-insulin mediated glucose transport. So that's not even to do with insulin sensitivity. So even if you are insulin resistant, you can still be using exercise as your means of decreasing blood sugar or mitigating high blood sugar.
Right, but that, exactly. So, but there's less, you know, glucose around to deal with.
Yep.
If you're doing that strategically.
That's good.
Yeah. And then certainly, not eating, as high of high glycemic foods, and a high glycemic load potentially. So that's one thing. But as for if it's inevitable, no, I don't think so. There's certainly, like I said, metformin, a lot of people are taking that. In the anti-aging realm. And the reason why is because when you lower hemoglobin A1C, which is a longer term marker of blood glucose. And I'll just say this, because maybe we'll get into this, is the two most important anti-aging markers, period, the end, is CRP and hemoglobin A1C. Everything comes from, it's a marker of systemic inflammation. And then really glycation. So those are like your two keys to aging right there, pretty much. That your two keys to almost all chronic diseases.
So let me ask you a question before we move on to that. I want to ask you this. If someone doesn't eat carbohydrates, I know you're an advocate of the ketogenic diet. So if someone doesn't eat carbohydrates, do they completely stave off insulin resistance? Or what would be the other pathway that would influence insulin resistance?
I think they do reduce. It's hard to say. Like, because there's some level of insulin sensitivity that you're improving by lowering your carbohydrate load, but you're also not taking in much carbohydrates unless you're trying to keep metabolically flexible. You may not be very efficient at carbohydrates, period, because you're so deep into ketosis and you don't need it. And it's kind of like how most people are with carbohydrates. And then when they try and, you know, go into ketosis, it's difficult for them. You know, it might take them several weeks. It might take them months to really adjust in. You know, in our society, that doesn't happen much. If you go back probably evolutionarily, I think we were very metabolically flexible.
Sure.
Like where we
also constantly weren't overfed though, right? Like our cells.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. We were hypocaloric a lot. We, in the winter, we probably went, you know, days without eating, and we were, you know, hunting food or looking for something to eat, and it was very difficult to find it. And, you know, in the summer, in the warmer months, maybe it was easy to find food, and this is before food storage and, you know, being able to, yeah, exactly. So, so I do think that we used to be metabolically flexible, and so that helps. I do think that you don't necessarily need to be full on keto, but I think trying to be more metabolically flexible would certainly help lower that risk for diabetes or, you know, insulin resistance. But I will say, I was just looking at this data the other day from the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, which is very prestigious.
Yep.
And it was from 2011 to 2012. And essentially, of those undiagnosed and diagnosed for type 2 diabetes plus those that are pre-diabetic, it was 52.3% of the population.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's of the America. That's in America.
Yes. Yes. So you've heard of the Western diet, or sure, more appropriately, SAD.
Yeah.
Because it's the standard American diet. And that is pathetic. And one of the things that frustrates me is when you walk into a convenience store, I mean, it should be called the addiction store, right? Because the A store instead of the C store, because you're literally surrounded by colorful, shiny things. And they have all your addictions there. Your tobacco, your caffeine, your sugar, your lottery. I mean, it's all there, right? So, and you look around, you know, and it's shiny, bright, colorful packages, shiny, bright, colorful liquids. And these food scientists work on something called the bliss point.
Yep.
I don't know if you know about the bliss point, but it's like, it's a certain amount of sweet, salty, acidic, bubbly, you know, or if it's food, it's like that little bit of crunch and oil. And it releases dopamine and serotonin. Think McDonald's French fries. Yeah. Think Coca-Cola.
Right.
I mean, it's all this stuff that's like, I mean, you can't stop eating. They literally, I watched a show on this. This food scientist was talking about like how passionately they work on addiction. And he talked about how on the front end of the soda that they were making, they had all the flavor, all the sweetness, and the back end had nothing. And he said, we design it that way so that you keep feeling, oh, it's so good. But then you're like unfulfilled at the end. So it's, wow, it's so good. So you keep drinking and drinking.
Right.
And you know, like the Lay's thing, you can only eat just one,
yeah,
or you can't just eat just one.
And the same thing with the soda. Like when you pop that can, that's like Pavlovian conditioning right there, right? Like every time you hear that thing open, you're like, oh, I want one. I want one. I want one. It's incredible how it's all thought out. And they're starting to do that with water, I notice now, man. They have water, like, you know, if you're a Dasani, when you open a Dasani, like it sounds like, yeah, a soda, right? I'm like, God, these guys are smart, man. They want, because people crave that. It's fantastic. I mean, fascinating.
Yeah.
So interesting.
Well, so I would recommend using something like metformin, or there's been studies that have shown berberine to be as good as metformin. And so I'm a huge fan of berberine.
What dose, Sean?
What's that?
What's your dose?
500 milligrams three times a day, two or three times a day.
And now, is that for everybody? So, is that for anyone? Let's assume someone's got, you know, diabetes. That, you know, you and I are healthy, young, vibrant dudes. Let's assume somebody's sick, diabetes, overweight. All that's okay.
So yeah, so that actually the studies that have been done with that dose are with diabetics, type 2 diabetics. But I have used it. So check this out. When I was playing around with this and a glucometer, I was in ketosis, and I tried this at two different occasions, both times when I was in the same level of ketosis. And I had a carbohydrate challenge with and without berberine. My carbohydrate challenge was a fun one. I made it for myself. So it was like five double stuffed Oreos and two Pop-Tarts. And I went up. I was, you know, I'm around like 65, 70. For baseline blood glucose. I went up to, and I was checking every 30 minutes, I went up to 199 at 2 hours.
Wow.
Without berberine. Now check this out, with berberine. So I don't even know if it was coming back down actually, or when it was. With the berberine, I never got above 100. And at 1 hour, I was already coming back down.
So was that like berberine immediately before, or is that just like kind of dosing every 3 hours or three times a day prior? Just one time?
No,
before?
That was one dose.
Wow.
That was one dose just prior.
So application for people listening, I mean, obviously, if you're trying to lose body fat, that has huge implications. The only time you wouldn't want to maybe do that is post-training, right? Like that post-training, you want that a bit of an insulin spike for most people if you are looking to build muscle, so which of a lot of our guys are. And then again, we could also extend the conversation. If you're training hard, you don't need insulin because you've got GLUT4. So you could kind of go both ways, but we don't need to go down that rabbit hole. But that's fascinating, man. And, you know, I've actually done that as myself as an aspiring bodybuilder through my career. I tested every single carbohydrate supplement on the market to see what it did to my blood sugar. like everything from, you know, I don't know if I should throw out names, but everything from Botargo to Carbolin and Waxy Maize and Dextrose and Grape Juice and Apple Juice and Bananas. I tried everything, man. And I tried to equate them. You know, I did about 100 grams. And I saw what actually influenced my blood sugar the most. And it was interesting. You know, I checked my blood. I did it 15 minute intervals for, an hour and a half. And I charted it all, man, because I wanted to see, well, what gives me the greatest insulin spike? And then, you know, I would manipulate things like alpha lipoic acid and see what happens. Like, so once I found the one, which, and I won't say what it is, but once I found the one, that I recommend or that I use, then I would see what alpha lipoic acid does to its ability to come back down. But I didn't know about berberine back then. Otherwise, I certainly would have experimented with that too. So fascinating. Do we know the mechanism that works on? Is it improving insulin, the cell's ability to use insulin, or just mitigating the insulin response? Or
yeah, it's known as a glucose disposal agent, and I think it is working along the lines of insulin sensitivity, like you said. But one of the things it does is, and this is a whole other conversation, is AMPK. You know, sometimes people think that means, you know, if you're firing up AMPK, that, you know, you're kind of shutting off muscle protein synthesis. I don't think it's that simple. I think it's a lot more complicated than that. I will say that I take it quite a bit, and I don't think it's hindered my gains, but that is another discussion that we could have.
Cool. Interesting, man. I don't know anything about the pathway, but that's maybe I'll write that down. We'll save that for the next podcast, because I definitely want to have you back on, man. So going down the route of improving people's brain, you know, I'm a huge, like, when people ask me how I eat, I just say, you know what, man, I don't eat anything inflammatory to my body, or I do my best. It's not always possible, but I do my best. That's the only guideline I put on myself. If something's inflammatory to me, I don't eat it. And that can be different person to person, which is an important thing to mention. But, you know, if I feel like something makes me mucousy, bloated, inflamed in any way, swollen head, literally anything, I just don't eat it ever again. That to me is the simplest way to eat. And if everybody could just eat that way, I think it would make a lot of sense. I don't attach to ketogenic dieting because I like to eat carbohydrates. I find my performance gets hindered, but I don't eat a lot of carbohydrates. I only need, you know, I eat mostly like a large amount of berries, to be honest. But yeah, so what's your thought with respect to inflammation and how that's influencing the long term, the big picture?
Right. And I like, you know, I am a keto person, but yeah, that doesn't make me the keto zealot. Like, sure. I feel like anyone who talks about keto now is now getting accused of being a zealot, and I'm certainly
it's,
not.
It's funny, right? Like, you got to be attached to one camp. You know, so we're interviewing this guy next week, which is going to be fascinating. This guy who's like the most extreme vegan doctor on the planet, and this is going to be such an interesting conversation to have with me, because I'm not against anything, but when you attach to something wholeheartedly, to me, it shows insecurity and ignorance at many levels. But anyways, sorry, didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's why I think, you know, I was talking about before the metabolic flexibility. I do keto because I definitely see the benefits, the science of it. And certainly I have a pituitary adenoma. So that creates a lot of issues in terms of my hormones, neurotransmitters, et cetera.
I didn't know that.
Also puts me at a higher risk rate for cancer. So, you know, I'm doing some of this to prevent that. It definitely does decrease inflammation, lower CRP, the inflammasomes, et cetera. So that is nice. But, like, I like doing the cyclical and targeted, you know, ketogenic. So I like to stay metabolically flexible.
Right.
Like we were talking about. And I think that's more typical of ancestral, evolutionary, primal,
sure,
paleo, whatever you
sure
want to call it.
So let's look at that, man. So, you know, not that we planned on going down the keto route, but I want to talk about, you know, keto influencing inflammation, decreasing CRP, and mitigating cancer, because I know a lot of people don't even understand that or don't even know how that starts to work. That could be a huge rabbit hole in itself, but just kind of quickly touching on the fact as to how you eat and maybe how that. And so I don't even know that if people have ever heard of this or if it's completely new to the conversation or if they know that it exists, the idea that, you know, because you sent me something very interesting a few weeks back, how ketogenic dieting influences cancer or maybe the manifestation or the display of cancer.
Right. So a few ways that, you know, Dom DiAgostino down in your area.
Yep.
Brilliant guy. He had a TED talk on that. And Dr. Siefried is kind of did the work before that on the metabolic model of cancer, where essentially, healthy cells are dual fuel, right? Like we were just talking about. And here's the problem. Like, I feel like, again, I'll go back to metabolically flexible. People bring up keto like it's this crazy thing. It's not a crazy thing. We should normally be able to use ketones and glucose. And I do on a regular basis. And I think our ancestors did on a regular basis. We weren't always in this glucose dependent mode. So we are meant to be dual fuel.
Yep.
And it's healthy to go some period of time without eating. It's healthy to tap into ketones. So with cancer cells, they only use glucose. So obviously a smart therapeutic approach that is showing a lot of promise is, you know, starving the cancer cells of glucose. So what it is that you're fueling off of is ketones, which you can, you know, use as fuel. So the healthy cells get the ketones. The cancer cells don't get the glucose, and it slows the rate of cancer. But also, you know, there's other methods that cancer may be propagated, and it could be mitochondrial dysfunction. And mitochondrial dysfunction is really at the root of almost every disease. If we go back before inflammation and glycation and some of these things, that the mitochondrial dysfunction is at the root of most chronic diseases.
But what's causing that?
A whole host of reasons, like, you know, that, you know, it could be, you know, and basically your diet, you know, lack of exercise, genetics, but a lot of different things that, like, we talk about that we know, like, are things that aren't healthy to do. You know, so protecting your mitochondria is important. So now there's like a lot of discussion around that. Things like PQQ, CoQ10.
So my understanding, man, and my question to you is this. Does it matter, or is it even relevant if you've got massive accumulation of inflammation? Like, can that stuff even get to the cell to do its job on influencing the mitochondria if you've got all this extracellular inflammation that's inhibiting the cell's ability to communicate?
I think you should do both at the same time, like address both. So I agree with addressing the inflammation. And so probably eating some kind of ketogenic diet or extremely low carbohydrate diet might be helpful over a short period of time to get those things kind of squared away, or maybe taking exogenous ketones. I mean, one thing that's interesting is that ketones will bypass the secondary complex of the electron transport chain. So that's actually, like, if you look at the mitochondria, that's what they're doing, the powerhouse of the cell. They're generating ATP, which is energy. So what's happening that's really cool with these ketones is that, you know, it's using this as a fuel and bypassing that. And that's where that mitochondrial dysfunction is. And that's why you've seen, like, especially with, like, neurological conditions, like, you know, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, neuroglioblastoma, which is a form of brain cancer that's, you know, inoperable and, well, I should say incurable, typically, definitely operable. But, you know, these kinds of things, see the most benefit because, you know, ketones can be used, really, I don't know if you know, like, Alzheimer's is known as type 3 diabetes.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's insulin resistance in the brain. And so there's a lot of this stuff going on that, you know, here these ketones can remedy some of these scenarios and improve your mitochondrial function and, you know, bypass areas of mitochondrial dysfunction, improve insulin sensitivity, decrease inflammation, decrease the inflammasomes, and decrease CRP. So, you know, that's where, like, this could get interesting for these scenarios, these conditions, certainly. And then, like we were saying before, you know, if it's potentially therapeutic for those conditions, you know, what is it doing maybe for the human to optimize them? And, you know, that's an interesting one. And there's not as much research in those areas. Certainly everyone's looking, there's not a whole lot of research in keto period, but, you know, the research that is going on is more in the therapeutic realm.
Right.
And certainly not on the human optimization realm.
Sure. So I know you do keto, and I'm being presumptive here, but I know you do keto and you see psychological benefits, brain benefits. Can you talk about that, like what you experience? And you don't have to get into the physiology. If you want to, if it's simple enough, you can. But I'd like to talk about that.
Yeah, you know, that's the cognitive clarity. And you know, I think it actually goes back to what we were just talking about. There's a fair amount of us that are insulin resistant. And then there's some of us that do have a fair amount of mitochondrial dysfunction. There's some of us that have neuroinflammation, right? So you're talking about systemic inflammation being out of control. There's neuroinflammation.
Yep.
And you'd be surprised at how much, you know, that brain fog really is there. And that's why, like, BDNF is important.
I'm not surprised, man, because I used to get it, man. I mean, I'm not surprised at all.
Yeah, so, like, things like BDNF come into the conversation, like, where the brain-derived neurotrophic factor.
Yep.
And that's extremely important to upregulate that. That actually protects neurons, and it actually can promote the growth of new neurons.
So
which
we know that's happening during ketogenic dieting. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, exactly. So, but that may be a result of some other things. I don't know that it's necessarily directly affecting it. It may be a result of providing more fuel to, you know, the brain cells by reducing inflammation, by reducing mitochondrial dysfunction, by improving insulin resistant scenarios. Like, I don't know if it's direct or indirect, but it's certainly happening. So that's, yeah, I definitely think so. Like, and basically the deeper you get into ketosis, and that's difficult to track. I know a lot of people want to track it with BHB levels, like with a, if you have a glucometer, you can get BHB strips. Yep. They're kind of expensive. And people say, I'm at two, I'm at three, like I'm at four, I'm at five. And they're trying to, you know, chase the best number. But that's actually difficult because the more adapted you become, keto adapted, the more ketones you use. And actually sometimes that could be a sign of like ketone resistance or something if you're actually very high, kind of like glucose. So it's better to say, like, I mean, it's okay to track the numbers, especially initially, but it's better to say, how do I feel? Because it can be very experiential. And you, if you ketogenically dieted, and you fasted, then you felt this, that you feel this cognitive clarity. And maybe just people fasting, you know, experience that too. And you're hypocaloric because essentially the same thing.
Yep.
And you'll feel that clarity. That's amazing that most people haven't felt in a long time. And it's because again, all those things that I was talking about, insulin resistance, inflammation, et cetera, mitochondrial dysfunction. And so it's not, you know, it's something that, you know, exogenous ketones could help with, you know, if getting good with fasting can help with, but I think if you're just a ketogenic dieter and you're eating several times a day and snacking, you're probably not getting into this cognitive clarity realm. I've talked to so many people that ketogenically diet that haven't. If you haven't added in fasting or exogenous ketones or something to kind of get you into a deeper state, then you don't know exactly what I'm talking about. But it's very amazing.
Yep.
What you feel like.
So I do it every week, man. I do at least 24 hours a week, 24 hours a day once a week. And sometimes I go 48 hours and there's certain points where you're hungry and that kind of takes away from your cognitive clarity. But once you get past that, it's really incredible, man. Like your brain just has this ability, especially if you have any amount of stored body fat, your body just starts going ketones and your brain goes, this is amazing. Provided your body has the ability to run on ketones, which again, that's a different conversation. So when we talk about, you know, you talk about ketogenic dieting, giving people this idea of like creating metabolic flexibility and eating whatever they want, that sounds awesome. But most people don't have the ability to control what goes in their mouth. So most of them need very, very specific guidelines. So it's hard, man. You know, you and I, I'm sure we eat very, very similarly from a perspective of like, I eat what I want, man. Like if I'm hungry, I eat it. If I want to eat ketogenic dieting, usually I'll eat ketogenic dieting. But if I eat something I don't like, I'm never going to eat that again, or if it doesn't feel great, right? If it doesn't feel great to me, I'm probably never going to eat it again. So, you know, we can instinctively fuel our bodies, whereas most people just don't have that ability. So what are some, like, daily habits that you've instilled that our listeners can maybe instill to allow them to get to the point that you and I are at, right? Because, you know, some very basic things that you're doing daily to maybe if you're doing any intermittent fasting or if you're doing, like, ketone supplements or if you're what your breakfast looks like or –
something to get their bodies using fats as fuel, because I've experienced it a lot with a lot, you know, some of my clients here in the gym come in and they go, you know, Ben, you took out my carbs and I feel like shit. I go, I know, but that's going to go away. Mm-hmm. So what are you doing on a day-to-day basis to either mitigate that or that you find is the best way to get you into, you know, a therapeutic ketosis range where your brain is using ketones for fuel?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people that I know that do ketosis or ketogenic dieting, sorry, you know, they struggle with like getting away from the junk foods and the desserts. So they just end up making ketogenic versions. and those things really override your satiety signal.
Sure. And, you know, they like, give you gut distress.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you can still overeat on a ketogenic diet. And it's really good to try and eat more savory and get away from like the sweets and then certainly add in, when you add in fasting, you really become a master over food and food doesn't control you as much.
Right.
In a deep way. Like, cause now you're not like we were talking about before, the addiction of like the dopamine, serotonin, like release with the colors, the sugar, the salt, the mouthfeel, the, you know, the oil, the crunch. You know, that all releases serotonin and dopamine, and it's an addiction. So having that control over food is so empowering when you fast. And it's very easy to start with fasting by doing intermittent fasting. You know, you don't have to go, you know, a day, 2 days, 3 days. You can do 18 and 6. So that means like 18 hours not eating and 6 hours eating in your 24-hour cycle. So.
Yep. People can do some damage in 6 hours, man. I've seen people do some damage in 6 hours.
Yeah, and that's fine. And I still think that's a great step in mastering food and not having it have so much power over you.
Right.
But 18 hours, I mean, that's not too hard to do because, you know, you sleep, let's say, 8 hours.
Yep.
And then wake up and go another 10 hours. Like, let's say you wake up at 6 a.m., and then, you know, you go 6 more hours to noon, then 4 more hours. So like 4 o'clock, 4 p.m., you can start eating until you go to bed, you know, 10 p.m.
Right.
And so, you know, you can get in your calories there and now you're fasting. And for guys that are worried about that and losing muscle mass if they're bodybuilders or whatnot, I know Jake and Ryan have, at ASPE, yep. Dr. Jake Wilson and Ryan Lowry have studied this and they found that, gains were not hindered at that level. They found that, maybe at the 20 and 4, where you're, you know, fasting for 20 hours and only, getting in 4 hours of eating, there may have been, some level of muscle loss, but, so at that 16 and 8, there wasn't. And I think that's a good direction to go as far as getting yep. used to intermittent fasting.
So I've played with it a little bit, man, and I haven't lost any muscle doing that, to be honest. Like for me to lose muscle, I was getting into 36 and 48-hour fasts. And I noticed, okay, I'm getting a little bit smaller here. I'm actually noticing a little bit, which is kind of my goal right now. But, yeah, with that, it's 18 and 6. I didn't. So one thing people are going to ask is, well, when do I train? So the one thing that I recommend to most people, to be honest, is 16 and 8. You can eat 8 hours. You can get 3 to 4 solid meals in that time. And I find they don't – I have a lot of people who tend to overeat during that six-hour phase. So if we give them this eight-hour phase, I find 3 solid meals during that phase and even 4 sometimes, and everybody seems pretty good. And that's not too big of a stretch. It's like you get to eat between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. Like, oh, that's reasonable, right? Mm-hmm. And people actually don't really lose any muscle. And guys are so surprised because I know every bodybuilder on the planet is so concerned with it. But you don't really start to lose muscle from what I experienced, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, until you get under 6% body fat. Like, I mean, that's subjective again. But once you start getting low in body fat, then maybe it's a little bit different. Then maybe you need to eat a little more regularly. But for most people who are walking around at 12 to 15%, the likelihood of you burning any muscle, it may happen in the first couple of times you do it because your body doesn't know how to use fats.
Exactly.
Yeah, so exactly. Maybe the suggestion is to become keto-adapted first.
Exactly.
And then introduce it. Yep.
That's it. That's it exactly. You nailed it. So, yeah, exactly. So because we know that when you're in ketosis, it's muscle sparing, right? Yep. So it actually improves that leucine threshold that I was talking about before, which may have to do with insulin sensitivity. So that threshold to turn on muscle protein synthesis is much lower in ketosis. Plus you have these anti-catabolic factors that are happening, that protect lean body mass. And that makes sense because ketosis is normally happens in starvation, right? And what do we want to protect in starvation? What do we want to use first for fuel? Right. And what do we want to protect most passionately is, you know, we want to use fat, we want to protect muscle, right?
Right.
So, exactly right. So once you adapt, I don't think that's very likely, especially like you said, if you have enough body fat.
So man, I said to my dad last week, I said, "Hey dad, we're going to do a little bit of fasting with you." He goes, "What do you mean fasting?" He's like, "I'm like, you're not going to eat." So most people's paradigm is very confused. And even a guy like Dominic who did 7 days of fasting and at the end of it still deadlifted 500 pounds, not having eaten. And you got another guy in Ireland, and I don't remember the exact numbers, I'm going to butcher it, but it was something like he fasted for about 350 days, no food, and lost 200 odd pounds of fat. Fascinating stuff, just to see what the body's capable of, right? Because we have this paradigm of like, oh, if you don't drink for 3 days, you'll die, which is probably true, but if you don't eat for 21 days, you'll die. It's not the truth, and people are afraid of like, oh, we have to eat every 3 hours, because we have this terrible paradigm around eating of like, you got to eat, because the American Heart Association says you need to eat every 3 hours. Well, because they're trying to drive industry, right? They're trying to make sure you go out there and spend your money and buy your food and, you know, go to restaurants and have dinner. It's all bullshit. I mean, it's all paradigms that need to be broken. And if someone's a conscious person, they're already aware of all this stuff. So I want to shift gears, man. I know we're getting deep into ketogenic dieting, but I know you don't have a lot of time. And I want you to talk about how you upgrade your brain. So you and I talked about microdosing LSD and nootropics. And if we can do that, I want to hear like what you're doing, man, and how what you're experiencing, because I know this is a huge thing right now, and it's kind of the hot topic everybody talks about. What do you experience when you're microdosing LSD? And I also want to talk about what nootropics you use on a regular basis.
Yeah, so when I'm microdosing LSD,
we can talk about this transparently, man. Because you know, I admit to have done it myself, so we can talk about it transparently, man. We don't like as long as you can, I will.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
Yeah, so I have experimented with it. I've never experimented with recreational drugs or anything on a hallucinogenic recreational drug level. But this I had read about quite a bit in terms of increasing what we were talking about before, BDNF,
yep.
And increasing cognitive capacity or function, if you will. So, it's very interesting to me. Obviously, I want to get the most of my brain. We've talked about optimizing ourselves. We're both high performers. There's a lot of expectations from us, from ourselves, from the people around us. We have high demands. So how do you get the most from your brain? And I had already used the pharmaceutical Nuvigil. I have a prescription for that, which is the active isomer of Provigil, modafinil. Which is a very commonly used nootropic. And my results were somewhat similar with actually with using microdosed LSD. What I noticed was it felt like I got a great night's sleep, even when I didn't. I felt more confident. I felt my thoughts coming to me more clearly, making those connections faster.
You say connections like in your brain or physically with people?
Yeah, both. I mean, that's an interesting, that's an interesting way of putting it. Yeah, exactly. So it's really both. Like I felt like I was, connecting the dots, if you will, faster in my head, but certainly it was easier to connect with people too. I think I was more readily aware of everything going on around me instead of maybe having as much tunnel vision. In life. So, you know, we can get hyper focused on things and that's actually very, very good because quite often we're way too distracted.
Yep.
But I felt like I was able to stay focused and grounded, but also be more aware of things around me, which is a powerful skill, really. So, it was definitely highly effective for me. I enjoyed it. I felt like it got better with successive use.
And what's your dosing schedule? Like how often?
I was just using it once a day in the morning. I don't do any caffeine, so I'm very sensitive to like these kind of things. So I was, reluctant to go all in. Even when I use Nuvigil, I only take like half a one. So, these things are, pretty potent for me.
Yep.
And that's what I used it, I think The most I used one was 4 days in a row. And like I said, with each time I used it, it got better and better. So I did like it quite a bit.
Now, so I'll tell a little about my experience just quickly, but so I use it to write. When I have to write a lot amount, like long, I can sit down 6-8 hours straight and not lift my head up as long as I got my headphones on. Like, I won't lift my head up and I'll just write, and it just flows. So it improves my creativity. It improves my ability to connect with people, I find. But I'm going to put a catch on that. If you're in an emotionally bad place, I think it's a terrible idea for you because it makes you more emotionally vulnerable, I think. So if you're in an emotionally bad place or if you're going to be around emotionally bad people, I suggest you stay away from it for the listeners. It's the other thing that I noticed I want to ask you about is, I haven't experienced this, but I haven't experienced it, but I've heard it's certainly not the type of thing that you want to do continuously, because I've heard some people have, like, everyone's personality is like, well, I want to do more. I want to do more and I want to keep going. And I feel like, so I think that this is not the place to do that. And, there is a point of diminishing returns, I believe. And I've seen some people start to get stupid. Like, if they're doing, I guess some guys like, oh, I've been doing it for 2 weeks. And I'm like, okay, I see a difference. I see, you know, in the beginning, you kind of see this increase and this rise. And then I feel like they get lost in the necessity to have that, and their creativity goes away and their focus goes away. And it just ends up being this big jumbled mess. So for those of you out there considering it, I've experimented with about once every 5 days, and it's a small dose, and it's massively effective. I use it when I need it to be creative, to write, to sit down and focus. If I'm trying to conceptualize the big picture of a business or of a project or of an article or something like that, that's when I find my greatest benefit. Or if it's about emotionally connecting with another person, I think that's a really good thing because you tend to just be very open and very honest. It's almost like, you know, your heart's kind of now open to this new thought of connecting with this person. So I don't know if you've experienced similar things.
Yeah, I have. Those are all great points. And I do think that if someone has an addictive personality, this is not the way to go.
I don't find it addictive, though. Like, I don't feel like I want it.
No, I don't. But if someone has had trouble with drugs in the past, you know, pharmaceutical, recreational, whatever, like just had issues that there's an abuse potential for them, I would say, please don't mess with this.
The best way to look at it, man, is like, you know, if you say you do 10 micrograms and, or 10 to 20 micrograms, and if you have the personality where you're like, well, I wonder what 30 would feel like. I think 30 would be better. If you're that guy, don't do it. Cause you're going to end up going down you're going to end up being hallucinating rather than being productive, right?
Exactly, and I want people to know that microdosed or not, it's still illegal.
Sure.
And I would like them to know, like, be sure if you do ever try this that you really, really, really trust your source. That's extremely important because you got to know what's going in your body. And,
right.
You know, you may have a very bad experience. You may have no experience. So that's some caveats that I would throw in.
I did it a long time ago in Canada, man, where, like, I think it's probably still a scheduled drug, but Canada just tends to be a little more laid back in these things. And, I don't know, it's just different, right? Like, as long as you're not being an asshole and selling it or giving it to kids or something, they tend to be a little more lenient in Canada. Like, nobody's going to come barging down your door. But in the U.S., it's just a different game, man. It's like, you know, it's a big deal, you know, so people need to be very cautious of where it's coming from.
Well, let me make this association. Like, so we know that alcohol, like one drink a day, actually decreases your cardiovascular risk, right? And that includes obviously wine because of some other benefits like the polyphenols, resveratrol, and all those things. But even beer, even one shot of vodka actually decreases your cardiovascular risk. But we also know that 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 drinks a day is going to worsen your cardiovascular risk, right? So it's the same thing, but at one level, it can be extremely healthy. At another level, it may not be.
Perfect.
Yep. So we can't say LSD, oh my God, that's the drug that, like, it's so bad for you because, no. Okay. So microdosed LSD is 1/10 the level of the hallucinogenic level. And right. I'm not even saying that.
And even 1/20th from
maybe 1/20th.
Yeah. Cause I've talked to some guys who used to, and so have you, the guys who used to use it.
And they're like, no, I used to do twice that. I'm like, oh, okay, now we get it.
Yeah, that's called the hero dose.
Right. One thing I want to ask you, man, this is a very interesting kind of controversial question. What is the line between pharmaceutical and supplement in your mind? And who's drawing that line? What is the line in the sand? And you know, who's drawing the line between beneficial and detrimental? You know, you see what I'm saying? So, like, I when I look at a supplement versus a pharmaceutical, what is the difference? Who makes that call? Do you see what the question I'm asking you?
No, like, not exactly.
So if we call something a pharmaceutical, what defines that as a pharmaceutical versus being a supplement? Like, what's the clinical definition, and who's drawing that line in the sand? Do you see what I'm saying? So supplements can be synthetic.
Exactly.
And so can pharmaceuticals. So what's the difference? Is it just that it's been designed by a pharmaceutical company?
Or is it
that the government wants to make money off of it? What is it in your eyes? Why can something be called a supplement but be massively efficacious and useful, whereas something can be called a pharmaceutical and be controlled and illegal? Ultimately, what's the difference?
I mean, both can work the same way. Most drugs are, you know, literally just inhibiting some enzyme somewhere in the body that this enzyme is known to affect this. So let's block that enzyme. And that's like, okay, we found this compound in nature. Let's isolate it. When you isolate a single compound, you can then patent it. And that's what's happened in the past. And that's where most of these drugs are. The problem is almost all these compounds are now known, and almost all these enzymes, if you will, I mean, they've all been pursued by pharmaceutical companies. There's very little left to patent. That's why you see, like, for a while, they were coming out with the mixed isomer of, like, a drug. And then 7 years later, they'd come out with a single isomer. Things like that. So, I'm trying to think. A great example would be, like, so Prozac and then Lexapro. I believe that's the one. That, they would just do this. And so, or you see sustained release or controlled release, or it's now two drugs put together in one pill, you know, which happens with diabetics and like an oral agent. That's what they're doing. There's not a whole lot of new IP that's coming out in the pharmaceutical realm.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, that's what it is. It's the ability to patent it. Then it goes through the trials, like with the FDA, et cetera, and, you know, gets approved as a drug. And, you know, they're not necessarily any better. In some ways, you can certainly argue that they're worse. Like, quite often, like there's a slew of compounds that we find have similar effects, but don't have many of the same side effects because, you know, if you inhibit like one enzyme, quite often the body will, you know, there'll be some buildup of this product, and then, you know, it'll find a way to get around that. That's homeostasis, right? Like, I mean, that's what we do,
right?
As creatures, is overcome like something that's, you know, in our path, and quite literally in this case, like in this pathway. And you'll see like with, for example, with the cannabinoids, and you know that. It's not just like CBD is helpful, but there's like a whole slew of cannabinoids that they've shown that like, you know, as taking the spectrum of them have greater benefit, like with autism, for example. And it's not just like CBD or THC that has the benefit. It's the full spectrum of them. And so, I think that happens quite a bit in nature, and we've tried to like, you know, isolate things down to this one compound and this one pathway. And it's not necessarily the best way forward, certainly for human optimization. You know, we want to be balanced as people. We want balanced nutrition, and we want a supplement that's balanced, that gives us that full spectrum of compounds. And so, you know, I feel that, you know, typically supplements are better for you. But you know, certainly, like I said, I mean, I look at things like metformin, Provigil. Right. I mean, I'm not like against, or LSD. I'm not against pharmaceuticals.
That's kind of where the question comes from, Sean, is the idea of it's very ambiguous, man. It's like, you know, marijuana is now quasi-legal, and you know, microdosing LSD is good for you. Too much LSD is very illegal. Like, It's just such a gray area, you know. Like some of these things are natural; they're naturally occurring in nature, but they're illegal. Some things are synthetic, but they're legal. Like, so it's just such a subjective thing. But you know, people hear, "Oh, that's a drug. That's illegal," and they automatically assume, "Oh, that must be bad for you." And just to extend that conversation, but who's the governing body that says one thing is bad for you, one thing is good for you, right? It's just the idea of. You need to know the pharmacology like you do of these things and see what's actually happening. And is it bad? Is it good? Because ultimately nothing in life is good or bad except in dosages, you know, ultimately or in uses, right? Something that could be very bad for one person could be very good for somebody else. So just putting a stigma on something is, I try to remove myself from any type of stigmas and paradigms.
Well, you know, a great example of inhibiting something through a drug that actually isn't healthy, but we're talking about, you know, reducing inflammation and that is healthy to try and do that. But when you inhibit the COX-2 enzyme, for example, I mean, we've seen with almost all those drugs, with even ibuprofen, you know, it started with like, oh, it's the, you know, Vioxx and, you know, some of these drugs that were, you know, much stronger in terms of COX-2 inhibition. But then, you know, we're even seeing ibuprofen in recent research, and that's actually increasing your cardiovascular risk dramatically for heart attack. Dramatically. Like, I think it was like, several fold, like threefold.
That's just like Advil. And that's just like, NSAID.
Advil, Motrin. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, so obviously, and you think, wait, you know, like I'm reducing inflammation, but again, you've narrowed it down to this one enzyme. And you're trying to block it. And there's some negative things that happen. Like those things, when you inhibit an enzyme, I think that can work acutely. That will not work chronically. Your body will figure something out.
Yep.
Homeostatically, to overcome that. And there will be some negative, reciprocation from that. So I wouldn't do anything that's enzymatic in nature. Chronically. And I think, you know, your approach to supplementation makes sense. And that's actually what I do too, is like, I try not to do many things very chronically, almost like we talked about being flexible metabolically.
Yep.
You know, I think that also is true with some of these nutrients we're taking in. I mean, does it make sense like to have something at like, you know, three times a day, every day? Like, did that happen in the past?
Never.
No.
Never.
No, like it doesn't make sense. So we should look to have, eclectic foods, eclectic supplementation, and not do something so rhythmically, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Man, amazing. I'm so grateful for you, man. So for all the listeners that want to reach out to you, you're on social media, Instagram.
Yeah, at Zone Halo.
Zone Halo, amazing. Sean and I are going to be doing a lot of stuff in the future together, so very few people do we energetically align with so well. So Sean and I are going to do some cool stuff. So if you guys enjoy Sean, reach out to him. Give him a shout out. Give us a review on iTunes. And let him know how awesome he is. And if you have any questions for him, you can you can hear the podcast at benpikulski.com/podcasts. And we're also going to be putting it up on the Muscle Expert site, man. Dude, I appreciate you.
Thank you so much, Ben.
Thanks very much for your
appreciate
time.
You being on.
I know you got to run.
Join us on BenPokulski.com to learn the cutting-edge techniques to take control of your body, your brain, and create your greatest life.